Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Cutting down on crime committed with guns starts with steering kids away from toy pistols and revolvers. So says historian Jonathan Zimmerman, professor at New York University. John, thanks for joining us once again on this episode of That's History.
Good to be here as always.
So let's go back in history. What came first, the gun or the toy gun?
Yeah. Well, the gun came first, but the toy gun came shortly thereafter. And there were toy guns manufactured in this country in the 1800s, but they really, really accelerated in the late 40s and early 50s, with, not surprisingly, the growth of television. Remember, these are the years where the percent of Americans that have a television goes from, say, 5% to 80 or 90% in a decade. And it's also during that era that you see these cowboy serials on television, Roy Rogers, Wyatt Earp, etc. And all of them have product tie-ins with guns. So we think that by the late 50s, there are 20 million toy guns that are sold each year in this country. And the vast majority of them are product tie-ins from television.
Now, following this thought, do toy guns lead to an interest in eventual purchase of real guns?
Well, nobody knows that exactly. Nor, frankly, do we have good evidence about whether playing with toy guns makes you, say, a more violent person. But we do know that recently, of course, toy guns have been involved in some awful, awful tragedies. So in Cleveland, 12-year-old Tamir Rice was killed when a policeman mistook the toy gun he had for a real gun. And that was on the heels of another episode in Ohio in suburban Dayton, where a guy at a Walmart had taken a BB gun off the shelf that somebody mistook for a real gun, and he too was shot by police.
So is it specifically the imitation guns that look all too real that you have a beef with, or do water pistols count, for example?
Well, I'm not the only person that has a beef with them. I mean, to go back to the history, toy guns peak in the 1950s, but in the 1960s, we start to see a reaction against them. It begins, not surprisingly, with the murder of John F. Kennedy, because his murderer, Lee Harvey Oswald, had acquired his gun through the mail. And obviously, a lot of toy guns were sold via the mails as well. And Dr. Spock and other psychiatrists started to suggest that we shouldn't have our kids playing with guns. You shouldn't give them as presents. And in the late 60s, actually, in 1968, after the murders of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Sears and Bloomingdale's both suspended toy gun sales that Christmas season because it was thought to be tasteless and too resonant with the overall violence in the society.
But just for the duration of that Christmas season?
Exactly. And I should say that in the 1970s, it appears that the sale of toy guns picked up again. Again, it was a product placement. It was Star Wars. The Star Wars series and franchise was so incredibly popular and profitable, and they sold lots of gear via it and some of it with guns. Then in the 1980s, we see a reaction against them. And there are a couple reasons for that, but one of them was that in 1987, a deranged person broke into a TV studio in Burbank out in L.A. and held a pellet gun to the head of the newscaster and said that he had to say something about secret creatures and the Central Intelligence Agency. I mean, this is obviously a deranged person. But that reporter, whose name was David Horowitz, actually then led a campaign against toy guns. And the following year, in 1988, we see the first federal legislation to regulate toy guns. Most Americans aren't aware of this because the regulations have not been particularly effective. But since the late 80s, there have been a variety of federal and state laws designed to regulate toy guns.
Primarily, again, with the intent of making them look less genuine?
Precisely. So initially in the late 80s, it was a law that if you were manufacturing and selling a toy gun, there had to be an orange plug in the end of it. Well, eventually they add a few other items that you could use to disguise the gun. If it didn't have an orange plug at one end, you could also put an orange stripe around the barrel, or you could give it a very bright or translucent color. These are all part of the federal codes that are meant to distinguish a toy from a real gun. But here's the problem. Actually, there were two problems. First of all, when the Justice Department did experiments where they had actors running around with these fake guns and police officers chasing them or accosting them, it turned out that in most cases, the police officers couldn't distinguish a fake gun even when the fake gun was according to code, that is, had these allegedly distinguishing features. The second problem was people would purchase the toy guns with these distinguishing features and then alter the guns themselves. So people would remove the orange plug or they would just repaint the gun to make it seem more real. So the effort to regulate toy guns via the law has been largely unsuccessful.
I'm thinking, fast forwarding to present day, with the advent and proliferation of, for example, 3D printers, even if you couldn't buy a toy gun in Walmart, you could probably manufacture your own.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Tragically so. And, you know, that's why I don't think that this is one of these social problems where the law is necessarily the answer, because we have tried with a whole variety of laws, not just federal, but state. And for the reasons that, you know, I just articulated, they haven't worked very well. It seems that what we need now are more voluntary campaigns. So in Cleveland, where this tragedy with Tamir Rice occurred, there's already been one that started. A group is starting a toy gun buyback where they propose to exchange toy guns. If you bring in a toy gun for either a book or perhaps another kind of toy or perhaps a ticket to a concert, to try to get, well, fewer toy guns off the toy guns out of people's hands and off the streets. And there are also campaigns urging parents not to give them as gifts this holiday season. Look, toy guns are not in themselves lethal, but they have absolutely been involved in lethal incidents.
You know, well-intentioned parents of young sons who promise up and down their kid will never play with a gun. Somehow there must be environmental, societal pressures, and kids, boys in particular, just love playing with guns.
They absolutely do. And again, I do think that that's deeply connected to popular culture. You know, in the 40s and 50s, there's this new cult of the cowboy, again, fed by television, but also fed by the Cold War itself. You know, it's important to remember, if you go back to the 50s and 60s, that there's a tremendous amount of concern about the way boys are being raised. This is the time of rapid suburbanization and, according to some American psychologists of the time, momism. Momism. Yeah, there was this fear that these suburban enclaves were mother-directed places because, according to the stereotype, dad was off at work. And moms were going to smother young boys and emasculate them. And one of the ways that guns were promoted, now I'm talking toy guns, was as an antidote to that. So if you don't want your boy to be emasculated by this kind of overweening momism, you get your boy a gun. Remember, it's also a time where we're supposed to be steeling ourselves for this long twilight struggle against a foreign enemy, the Soviet Union. And toy guns were absolutely a part of that, too. So we want our young men to be strong. We don't want them to be feminine. We want them to be masculine. But we also want them to be martial figures. We want them to have the steel and the strength to fight the enemy.
So perhaps now we've evolved from cult of the cowboy to cult of the cowboys, with sport and football as a surrogate for combat.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and obviously guns and toy guns aren't the only way that we've been socialized to express our masculinity, but they're certainly one of them. And I think since the 1950s, one of the primary ones.
I could imagine, though, those who decry the slippery slope would wonder what would be next. Lightsabers, knives, toys?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because one of the points that that came up in my research of this is that it shouldn't surprise you that Walmart, since it's the biggest retailer in the country, is also a big retailer of toy guns. But a couple of years ago, Walmart decided it wasn't going to retail imitation cigarettes, candy cigarettes, because, well, there was some pretty strong research showing that candy cigarettes socialize people into smoking, and that people that use candy cigarettes as kids were more likely to be long-term smokers than people who didn't. And Walmart made this, I thought, a very noble and very public announcement that for these reasons, for the danger that was inherent in this, you know, this imitation cigarette, that they weren't going to market it anymore. And so my question would be, well, you know, why then market these toy guns? The toy guns are not any more inherently dangerous than toy candy, if you will. But obviously they've been associated with all kinds of danger. And I would urge Walmart not to sell toy guns for the same reasons that they don't sell imitation cigarettes.
Gosh, if only they'd banned candy beer when I was a young child. Thanks,
Precisely.
Jonathan.
Thank you. It was good to talk.
Historian Jonathan Zimmerman, professor at New York University, joining us again on this episode of That's History.